I'd like to start with where were you born and your early schooling.
Okay. I was born in a little town 35 miles north of New York City called Ramapo, R-I-M-A-P-O, New York. My parents were Polish immigrants. They were both from Poland. My father came to this country when he was 17. My mother came to this country when she was 14. My mother had received a very minimum amount of education in Poland as a friend of another girl who had private tutors, and so when they hired the private tutors, they wanted the girl to have a companion going through school. And so she was educated in that manner. My father had no formal education at all. My mother taught me to read and write Polish and read and write English, which we learned together in this little town, which was a steel mill town, company town. And I went to a grade school in Hilburn, New York, which was about 3 miles away. And then I went to high school in a place called Tuxedo, New York. I guess I was always at the head of my class. And then in 1943, Tuxedo, New York was a very small high school. There were only 25 kids in the graduating class. But I was walking by the principal's office, and the principal allowed us how the she'd received some examinations for Navy officers training, and I had to be 17 to take the exam. The exam happened to be given on April 2nd, and I was 17 on April 1st. And I was a senior in high school, so I took the exam. And in June of 43, I received orders to report to the Navy, which made me, I was just 17 in April, and I went into New York City and took the examination and was sent to St. Lawrence University in Northern New York State in a Navy program called V-12. Which was an officer's training program. And I stayed there for approximately 16 months, which is the equivalent of 4 semesters, 4 months each of college, and I completed 2 years of college when I was 18. I'm still 18. And the Navy then sent me to a pre-midshipman school, and then they sent me to midshipman school at Cornell University, and I graduated as an ensign, and I was still 18, almost 19 by that stage. And then the Navy sent me to Harvard, to a cryptography school. And I was at Harvard for 4 months. And then they sent me to a destroyer school for another 3 months. And then they sent me overseas to Japan. It's my recollection that the war ended on my way to Japan. Signed to a destroyer minesweeper as a communications officer. And stayed on board there until I had completed a total of 3 years in the Navy, obviously most of which was in the school. Came back, got out of the service, and went back to St. Lawrence University and obtained a degree in mathematics. And then hitchhiked to the University of Miami. In Florida, decided to go to law school. Got admitted to the University of Miami.
Was the mathematics degree an undergraduate degree? Yeah.
Yes.
And why did you decide to go to law school?
Well, I had always wanted to be a lawyer. When I was a small child, I would go over to the neighbors and read the newspaper, and read the whole transcript of the Bruno Hauptmann trial, which in those days used to show up in the New York papers on a daily basis. In addition to that, my good friend in high school was a lawyer who happens to be in Anchorage, Alaska. We grew up together and went to high school together. His name is Roger Cremo. He's the general counsel for the First National Bank, with whom I had lunch. We have been friends for 40 plus years. And his uncle was a lawyer. His uncle was always encouraging both of us to become lawyers.
This is back in Ramapo.
Well, he lived in Tuxedo.
Yeah,
in high school. Ramapo is about 6 miles from Tuxedo, 2 miles from Hillsborough. And so on the basis of those factors, I decided to go to law school. The reason I got the degree in math is that the Navy training is primarily engineering, math-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easier for me to get the degree in math than it was to go get a degree in some field of political science or economics or whatever. Although at my final year and a half at St. Lawrence, I just took one math course and concentrated in liberal arts and sociology, philosophy, psychology, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you graduated from Miami, University of Miami?
No, I got married. And decided I didn't want to live in the Northeast or in the South, so I moved out west and moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and graduated from the University of New Mexico.
How long did you stay there?
Not very long. I got married in 1949, and I started September of 49 at the University of New Mexico, and so I finished the 49-50 school year. When the Korean War broke out, and I didn't have to have a PhD to figure out that if the Navy had given me all this training, they were going to extract something from me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Korean War broke out in June of 1950. I received orders to go back into the Navy in approximately September of 1950. And I got a deferment to finish one day more than one half of my last semester of law school. Was recalled to the Navy, and in November of 1915, and gave two more years of my life to the United States Navy, which I guess I owed them. But I was operations officer on a destroyer, and then executive officer on a destroyer. I was in Korea for 8 or 9 months, something like that. And then I got out of the Navy in November. Well, while I was in the Navy, I took the New Mexico bar exam. Mm-hmm. I leave to fly back to New Mexico and take the bar. And so I took the bar and passed it.
What kind of exam was it?
It's a regular bar exam.
You didn't have to take off time to study for it or anything like that?
Well, I was an energetic young guy, and I had written to University of Arizona, they had a bar review course which they wouldn't allow to be taken off the campus. But since I was on a destroyer in the middle of off the coast of Korea, I guess that figured it would make a lot of difference. I wasn't going to give it to anybody else. And, so they sent me the course, and so I studied it on board the ship. And then I guess I got about a 15-day leave, and I flew back to Albuquerque and holed up in a motel, and drove up to San Francisco, took the bar, and got sworn in March of 52 while I was in the service. And actually, I don't know whether I've been lucky or bright or what, but actually the Supreme Court, because I was a lieutenant in the Navy with 2+ rows of battle ribbons and all kinds of fancy jazz, they directed the examiners to correct my paper and convene the court and swarm me in immediately.
Oh. That's nice treatment.
So then I went back to the destroyer and was engaged in a variety of training exercises on the destroyer. And,
did you ever have a chance to go into the JAG Corps or anything like that? That's not the Navy, but is it?
Not really. I applied. I obviously speak, read and write Polish, as I've indicated to you, and so I applied to go into intelligence on a number of occasions, and I also applied for the JAG Corps, but what happens is if the Navy punishes competence, and if you're a competent naval officer, they don't want to let you go.
Mm-hmm.
So commanding officer writes in and says, yeah, this guy's a help guy, I'd love to see him go, but I don't think you ought to take him now, so you really get beat out, whereas if they're not competent, they get rid of you.
Mm-hmm.
And, but in any event, they never would get rid of me. They kept me on board the destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's your next
one? After the war, after your 2 years, after 1952, then what did you do? Did you go back to New Mexico?
I went back to New Mexico and was going to set up a practice there. And I decided that I would come and look at Alaska.
Why?
Well, you know, I had heard a lot about it, read a lot about it. I wanted to see it. I figured if my parents were smart enough to emigrate from Poland, I'd be smart enough to emigrate from to a newer country. And so I, in November of 52, I put my personal belongings in storage and flew to Alaska.
With your family or with?
I just had a wife.
With your wife?
Yeah.
Did she go with you to Alaska?
Yeah.
Was Roger Cremer already here?
Mm-hmm.
Had he been practicing law?
Yes.
Did he tell you that it was a good place to practice?
Yes. And I had another friend who was already here, who's now deceased, whose name is John Connolly.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been in law school with me in New Mexico.
And he was already up here too?
Yes.
Had either of them been in the war? Or did they?
I didn't understand you.
Had either of them been in the Korean War?
Negative. I was obviously delayed 2 years to the extent that I was in the Korean War.
Yeah. When you arrived, what was it like here?
Cold.
What time of the year did you get?
November of 52. And that's my recollection is there were only two paved streets, Fourth Avenue from about Gamble to L. And 4th Avenue south on Gamble to about 15th. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it was all dirt streets. I was getting a job once I got here, and I went to work for Mr. Cremer as his law clerk.
Hmm.
Which job I didn't have before I came. But I guess I assumed if I asked him for a job, he'd give me one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he paid me $300 a month, I remember that. And that's when I started out.
Did he work with any other lawyers?
Well, he had previously been associated with Dan Cuddy's father, Warren Cuddy. And I think the original name of the firm was Cuddy, Cuddy and Kay. And then subsequently he was associated, that firm broke up and Cuddy and Cuddy left. And then I think the name was, the next firm was Kay Robinson and Moody. And then he had left K. Robinson Moody and established his own practice.
Mm-hmm. So you worked with him when he was just alone?
Yes, ma'am.
Was this right in January, in November, when he gave
That's
you the job?
That's when I started out, yeah.
When did you take the bar?
I keep telling you, I was lucky.
You tell me you didn't have to take the bar.
I almost didn't. Somebody passed a law through the legislature before I got here that said since there was a substantial shortage of attorneys, that if you were a clerk in a office of an attorney who was engaged in the general practice, you could get a temporary certificate to practice. And so I applied for a temporary certificate and got it. I'm not sure, but I think I'm the only guy who ever got one.
Who did you apply to get it?
The Attorney General of the state, who then informally acted as the chief of the informal Alaska Bar Association, who in those days, his name was J. Gerald Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And then in November of 53, which was the year after I came here, I got admitted to the territorial bar.
Did you have to take an examination?
Yes, I did.
What was it like?
I'm not sure I can remember that. It was just another bar examination.
It wasn't any different from in Mexico.
No.
Did you ever have to go before court?
Yeah. For what purpose?
For questioning?
No.
To pass the bar?
No. The bar was, the exam was administered by Mr. Williams, who was the Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
And my suspicion is that he was quite arbitrary in making the determination as to who passed.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Fink and Mr. Arnett and another person didn't pass
Kerman
that year, and sued him, and I think he vowed that he would never admit those SOBs for the rest of their natural lives. Arnett went and made peace with him somehow. Fink never did get admitted out. I don't know what happened to him.
Kerman must have made peace or done something, because he became a member of the bar later.
Okay. Some of the guys that took the bar with me were Neil McKay, Gordon Hartley, John Norrader was before me, Ed Murdy, and I can't remember too many of the others of
them. Mm-hmm. Do you remember some of the old members of the bar?
Certainly.
That were there at that time?
Certainly.
Want me to tell me about some of them?
Well, I'm going to go ahead with my story. I passed the bar in November of 53. For whatever reasons, I made the determination that I would have to go off on my own, that because of our long-standing friendship, if I wanted to retain his friendship, I ought to go my own way. So I left Mr. Cremo's office, and in January of 54, I went into the U.S. Attorney's office as an assistant United States attorney.
Was this under J. Gerald Williams?
No, J. Gerald Williams was the state attorney general. Had no control over the DA's office.
Okay.
DA's office was a federal post. Yeah, there's the certificate. Did you get do I have one yet?
No.
I've got a United States attorney certificate. Anyway, you're appointed by the U.S. attorney general.
Uh-huh.
And you serve, there's one around here someplace, and you serve at the pleasure of the federal government, and you're in the Department of Justice, and you report to the Department of Justice, and your additional duties were to enforce the territorial laws and territorial crimes, and there were four of us in the office, Judge Fitzgerald. The U.S. attorney was a guy named William T. Plummer, who's Ray Plummer's brother.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn Kirkland, who's gone back to Florida, and myself, and that was it. Consequently...
What kind of cases did you have?
Well, there were only four U.S. district judges and only one U.S. district judge here.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the population was here. Therefore, there was a substantial backlog of criminal cases, like 3 or 4 years. So I lived in the courtroom, trying murder cases, manslaughter cases, all kinds of cases, all kinds of criminal cases.
All before McCary, Judge McCary?
Well, as I started out, some visiting judges would come in. Judge Folter from Juneau would come in. And occasionally the guy from Fairbanks would come in. And occasionally we would have visiting judges from the lower 48. So, but the bulk of them were in front of either Folter or McCary.
Did you ever have to Who is the visiting one from Fairbanks? Is that Hep?
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 No, Hep was a state judge.
Was there a big difference in the techniques of the different judges? The way you could tell how they were going to rule?
Well, Judge Folta had been a former assistant United States attorney, and he therefore was extremely partial towards the government in the prosecution of criminal cases. Judge Diamond was a wonderful old gentleman who was extremely fair. Neither Diamond nor Folta had had any formal legal training. Neither one of them had been in law school.
Did you have any cases in front of Diamond? Were you here at that time?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Didn't he die in 53?
Well, I had cases in front of him, though, when I was practicing for Mr. Claremont.
Oh.
I guess he did die in 53, I wasn't certain, but Mr. Cremo and I tried some cases in front of him. But in addition to this criminal calendar being, I don't know, maybe 4 years in exaggeration, 3 or 4 years behind, civil calendar is also 3 or 4 years behind. In most of the defense attorneys were from the old school, you know, the Grigsbys, McCutcheon, Nesbitt, Renfrew. All the old heads.
Why do you call them the old school?
Well, because they were in private practice, and they had all performed their alleged apprenticeship as assistants in various variety of offices, and they were the whole bar, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were, in some instances, in most instances, maybe it's not fair to say most, they were the traditional defense attorneys. Grigsby was an absolute genius at being a defense attorney. I don't think Grigsby had any formal legal training. I know McCutcheon never had any formal legal training. But they had been practicing law for a substantial number of years, and if you're a young lawyer and you get into the courtroom with them, you learn very quickly. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any particular cases where you learned fast?
I can name a lot of them. Oh, there was a criminal case that Judge Fitzgerald and I prosecuted, which we were convinced had racial overtones. It was a community just to the south of 15th, where the lake is now, called Westchester Flats. And it was then it was up the river, there's Eastchester Flats. Eastchester Flats was a black area where all the nightclubs were. Everybody lived, if you had a criminal case, everybody lived at 17th or 18th in Carlock. And I always envisioned a monstrous skyscraper there. There wasn't anything there. I used to use that as an address. But in any event, there was a guy that was beat up by black guy that was beat up by two redneck types. They beat him so hard that they had a bucket, a water bucket, and they flattened it over his head,
let's see, it was absolutely flat. We had the order number. We charged them with assault with a dangerous weapon, the water bucket. Grigsby and Harold Butcher defended the two guys. And the prosecuting witness, this black guy that had been beat up, had testified that he hadn't had anything to drink prior to the fight. So they took off on that issue and produced a Catholic priest, Dr. O'Malley, who was one of the most famous doctors in town at that time, and one or two prominent businessmen, all of whom testified that the black guy was drunk at the time he got beat up. And so the jury acquitted them. And I guess that was a valuable lesson.
What did you learn from it?
Well, I guess I learned that you got to examine your prosecuting witness sufficiently so that he doesn't make errors of this kind. He obviously had had something to drink. He denied it to both Fitzgerald and me. And we obviously didn't sufficiently prepare. We were running in and out of the courtroom trying cases on a daily basis. And if he'd said that he'd had something to drink, then that's where the smell came from, that would have been the end of it, I guess. But he absolutely swore he had never touched a girl.
Do you remember any other cases? Who was opposing counsel? Oh, it was Butcher and Grigsby. That's right. Do you remember any other cases like that?
Well, I remember lots of them. I subsequently became partners with McCutcheon and years later. But he was defending a guy for seriously having beaten up another guy dealing him. The only independent witness to the fight was a young lady, native lady, who happened to be in the cabin with him. And McCutcheon impeached her with a handwritten statement signed by her in which she said that the defendant didn't really beat up the prosecuting witness. And she wouldn't interview me, and obviously the defendant was friendly with her. And she wouldn't interview me, and sort of an offhand question. I was afraid to ask her a question. I didn't know what the heck she was going to say since I'd never interviewed her. And she obviously was friendly with the defendant. But I badgered her a little bit, and finally, I said, and under what circumstances did you sign that statement in which you said the defendant didn't do this? She said, the defendant held my other hand over a hot candle until I signed.
Oh.
But probably the most illustrious case, and you probably ought to go read the readings, it's a hell of a case, is United States versus Stringer. And Fitzgerald and I were assistant district attorneys. Stringer was a prominent lawyer. The disciplinary power rested in the bars in the DA's office. And
David Talbot was an assistant DA prior to us. He was one of our predecessors. And he filed this disciplinary proceeding against Stringer.
Mm-hmm. Could anybody file disciplinary proceedings?
Any DA.
Any DA. Did they have to have a complaint from somebody?
Yeah.
So anyone off the street could file them with the DA? That's what. Okay.
Talbot filed a number of them. He said, don't publish this next part. This is in confidence. I don't turn it up. I don't care. I don't trust you. But he's a little bit goofy, and he filed a whole bunch of them. But in any event, the charge was, and Stringer had been very prominent, and he'd been a Republican National Committee man. And Talbot was going to clean up the bar. And he was sort of a young crusader. And I'm not suggesting that he didn't believe that Stringer had done anything wrong, but the argument was that Stringer had overreached a client. And the client's name was Kemp, who was a cab driver. The charge was that Stringer charged him $2,500 to get a criminal complaint for white slavery dismissed. We, in our capacity with DAs, prosecute cases of white slavery under the Mann Act. And the thing really got to, not only have to read the case file in U.S. versus Stringer, but you have to read the case file in U.S. versus Talbot.
Why?
Well, because the story is related in those two reported cases. But in any event, Fitzgerald and I made the determination that we didn't think that Stringer had overreached the client. Stringer had been instrumental in getting McCary appointed to the bench. So we went to court and asked that the case be dismissed. And McCary wouldn't dismiss it because he didn't want to be accused of favoritism. And he said, I want you to go ahead with the trial anyway, and I will make the determinations of whether it should be dismissed. So Stringer got the cream of the bar. Everybody, there was anybody in the bar, Kay and Grigsby. I didn't know who else, but I knew he had a whole collection of defense attorneys. And Fitzgerald and I prosecuted the matter, although we had previously recommended to the judge that it be dismissed. But he insisted that we go forward. So we presented the case to him. He had incidentally previously disqualified himself.
Can I ask you?
But then he went on to hear it, so there wouldn't be any charges of partiality.
How can he disqualify himself and then go hear it anyway?
That's what the Circuit Court of Appeals said. But in any event, he heard the case. Yes? Thank you, finally. I think he finally decided that Springer should be. I'm not sure what he decided, but I think he decided that he should be reprimanded. And then, of course, they appealed it. And the Circuit Court of Appeals reversed it on the grounds that
who had previously disqualified himself when he couldn't hear it, and that was the end of it. In the meantime, there were substantial disputes between Talbot and Fitzgerald and Groh. That all culminated in a contempt citation against Talbot for not testifying truthfully.
Not testifying truthfully in Stringer,
in the Stringer case. Mm-hmm. And then McCary, who by this time was furious with Talbot, wrote a long opinion in which he acquitted Talbot of not testifying truthfully, but called him a liar.
So did you feel like you'd won the case anyway?
I don't know. Yeah, there were a number of other disciplinary cases that I inherited from Talbot. One against Bailey E. Bell, who was Margie's father.
In-law.
Another one against a guy named John Shaw, that I ended up disbarring. I never disbarred John Shaw. I mean, Jim Swan, that I ended up disbarring.
How long have you been here?
Oh, a number of years. She had some dandies. He drank a lot, didn't pay a lot of attention to his work. Guy comes in for divorce. He says, okay, I'll represent you. He says, but I got to get an appearance and waiver signed. He gives the appearance and waiver to the client. The client goes downstairs to a bar, finds some girl. She signs the appearance and waiver. The client brings it back to Swan. Swan notarizes it. He goes ahead and gets the divorce for the guy. The wife is back in Minnesota, Wisconsin, or someplace. She doesn't even know she's divorced. She comes back and says, what happened? It's not really funny, but it's typical. Then there were a number of cases where you'd have some guy sign complaints and never file them, statute of limitations. Never file a complaint. But anyway, he got this one. Another case I had that I inherited from Talbot was against John Shaw, who practices in Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really close question, but I wrote the Department of Justice and asked them to let him plead nolo. Chief Justice Berger was then head of the criminal section of the Justice Department. I still have the letter from him, but I said nothing to it. But in any event, I was forced to try it, and because the Justice Department wouldn't let me dismiss it. It's a fascinating case. But in any event, convicted and I think fined $100.
What was the charge against
him? The conflict of interest. And I always had terrible doubts about it.
What were you then? What was the situation?
Well, this national administration changed. The Republicans had come to power and they were interested in establishing some precedents on conflicts of interest. John Shaw was a dispatcher of the Alaska Railroad. And so he trained somehow. He was on the north board, Anchorage to Fairbanks. The guy on the south board was somebody else. There was a terrible accident down around Indian where some people were working on the railroad. Obviously, they never got the word. Locomotive came in and hit them, and I think
for the 13 people injured, six or seven of them, maybe as many as eight, were killed. The guy on the south board got physically sick. Shaw went over and helped handle the rescue operation on the south board. He performed his duties in a tremendous manner. He subsequently left the railroad, went to law school, and went to work for Harold Butcher.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold Butcher had the case against the United States for the injuries to the workmen. Shaw did some work on the case. Talbot decided that he was using information that he obtained from his employment, and therefore charged him with seldom used, but nevertheless the statute of conflict of interest. And that was the case. You know, from my standpoint, Shaw's conduct was impeccable. I don't know whether he obtained any information that would have been of any assistance to him in running the rescue operation, but the United States government thought he did. I tried to get them to agree to get rid of it, and they just wouldn't do it. They directed me to prosecute, and I ended up prosecuting, and got convicted.
So there were those three. Oh, the other one was Bailey Bell. The Bailey Bell case he brought.
What was the case?
Was there a case? Yeah.
You know, I don't remember what the heck happened to it. Bailey, Talbot accused Bailey of going through his files.
This is the district attorney file?
Yeah.
Oh.
They were in the old federal courthouse, and Bailey, I wasn't there, and I didn't prosecute the matter, and I think it was disposed of before I got to the DA's office. I'm not certain of that. But as I understand the facts, there, you know, the counsel table, Bailey was in the court during a recess and allegedly at the wrong desk.